January is finally here, said no one ever. For all the excitement over the new year, the first of the month is actually quite gloomy. But there is plenty of art to see in galleries and museums to help keep your mind off the cold gray environs. And today on KCUR Central Standard, we're going to try and inspire you to do just that. I'm Gina Kaufman. Let's start with an exhibit at the Kemper where you can see boats suspended in the air like a fleet of some kind. They're very intricate and visually breathtaking, but the artist who made them is working through complex questions about the history of colonialism. Hugh Locke, with us from London, good morning.
Good morning.
You have called this show Here's the Thing. What does that mean?
Oh, goodness. A tricky question straight away. I know, I'm joking.
No, it's okay.
It just seemed like the right title. It's almost like, here's the thing, here's where we are, here's where I am at this moment, here's my thing, so to speak.
Yeah, the fleet of boats that I just described is really kind of the centerpiece of this exhibit. And I'd like you to explain what those are, how you made them.
Yes, well, a lot of them are made in the studio, my studio, and then some of them are bought on eBay and heavily customized, so they're unrecognizable from what they were when I bought them. And to create a large flotilla, and it's ranging over history, so it's talking about things like refugees, it's talking about trade. There are two Mayflowers in there. It's talking about colonial history and issues with colonial history and stuff like that. It's a wide-ranging thing. And a number of these boats have United Nations medals fixed onto them. This, again, referring to the UN issue, connection with the Mediterranean refugee crisis.
And they have different kinds of details, like there are plants growing up over every side of some of these boats, like they're almost being overtaken by plant life. And then some of them, it's more like triumphant, like flags and cargo,
Yeah. I mean, basically, as a general rule, they're all a bit wrecked. They're all sort of falling apart, you know, sort of like broken objects of past and present history. And the plant life is a bit like imagine something going through the Sargasso Sea and basically just stuff accumulating on these things.
The boats are amazing, but there are also other things in the exhibit. Like, this is just how I would describe it, a classical sculptural bust sort of covered in gilded stuff. And it's hard to describe. It is opulent, but in a, like, not super appealing way.
Yes, I'm glad you got that. So what these are is the series is called Souvenir, and what these are antique busts, and these are Victorian busts of the kind which would stand on people's mantelpieces in Victorian times, and it's a riff on these are mass produced objects for the middle class and lower middle class in Victorian times. And it's for people who couldn't afford to go on the Grand Tour.
What is the Grand Tour?
Oh, the Grand Tour. Sorry, I should have explained that. The Grand Tour is Lord so-and-so in the 18th and 19th century traveling to Italy, going for what was called a Grand Tour. Basically, you went on an educational tour to see Michelangelo's David, to see Mona Lisa, to see all these famous things. And then you come back with a whole load of stuff, usually fake stuff, a load of junk, but occasionally some decent stuff as well. And the things these guys would come back in neoclassical times in the 18th century would be these white marble busts. The busts I'm working on, they're not that at all, but they're trying to imitate that. In the US, you'd have a similar kind of bust for, say, I know, Lincoln or Robert E. Lee. Exactly the same type of thing. And they're unfired porcelain.
Huh. Okay. But so I do understand that this whole topic is really personal for you. You grew up in Guyana.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So I grew up in Guyana, and I arrived in Guyana as a very young boy from Edinburgh. And I saw the country come into being. I saw the independence. I saw the flag being designed. I saw the coat of arms being designed. So I've got a real interest in how countries invent themselves and how they create the symbols.
You that, kind of like rushed over, I saw the independence.
Yes, well, yeah, I arrived in time back in 1966. I arrived in time for Guyana's independence. So my earliest memories are of that and of receiving a present on Independence Day, because we were told that this was what was going to happen by our school teachers.
That must have left a pretty huge impression to be a country gaining independence at that impressionable young age.
It did leave a very, very strong impression, and learning the national anthem and stuff. All this stuff was brand new. And seeing...
Yeah, like grown-ups were also learning the national anthem. Right?
Exactly. And so it gives me, when I say go to the US, I'm very conscious of how the US symbols are being made. When I'm in Britain, I always see these things as an outsider to a certain extent, even though I'm living here for a very long time. I sort of see it as through fresh eyes, I would like to think.
Did you feel the reverberations of colonialism in your life growing up in Guyana, even though colonialism had just ended upon your arrival?
Yeah, I mean, be blunt. I mean, you knew that that if you were white, you were in a better position in society than somebody else who wasn't. And this is an ironic thing for me to say, considering the fact that I'm mixed race and my mom was white and my dad was black, you know. So you're very aware of things like that. And the school I went to had a hangover where it wasn't until I was 11 or 12 that I started learning Caribbean history. Up until then, it was all about British history and history of the Roman Empire. And when, as an adult, you look back and you think, that was a bit weird, wasn't it, you know?
Yeah, that is a bit weird. I mean, do you remember the beginning of learning Caribbean history?
Absolutely.
And being
absolutely.
Sort of like, whoa,
Exactly. I remember the beginning of learning Caribbean history and thinking, oh, hang on a second, this is interesting. And so as a result of that, years down the line, I started doing these very strange images of the Queen and looking into what that meant to me. And it's a sort of dragging up childhood memories, but somehow them not dragging them up in a subconscious way, you know?
You know, the image of the boat is really interesting to me. Can you talk about your own personal history with boats?
Yes. Well, Guyana was... the name means land of many waters. So to get anywhere, there weren't that many bridges in the country. To get anywhere at any distance, as a kid and until I was in my late teens, you would have to travel by ferry or by outboard motorboat or something like that. And this was a common thing.
So now you do live in England, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
What is it like to live in a country that colonized the place where you grew up?
it's interesting. I mean, obviously, I've been living here for a long time, but it's put it this way, it makes me create the work I create. So when I'm working on these busts, or when I'm thinking through issues of what these busts mean to me, and the busts are about ideas. The busts, obviously, they come out, as I said, they've come out of a mass-produced kind of thing for the Grand Tour, as I was talking about before. But they're images I grew up with as a kid, so it's about that. But what they're about as well is a flip side to programs like Downton Abbey and Young Victoria, which is the way Britain sells itself, in particular to the US and around the world, for example, a very successful product. And I'm proposing something which is a flip side of that. Yes, it's a product. I mean, Downton Abbey is a very successful product. I mean, it gives an idea of Britain which is very careful construct, shall we say, you know. And things like Young Victoria, all these things are the way Britain sells itself. And what I'm doing is sort of commenting on that. So all the busts I've got there, if you look closely, they're layered layers of decoration, but layers of history. So they're things like medals from the Benin expedition, which ended up with the Benin bronzes in the Metropolitan Museum. So it's about medals from the Ashanti War. Essentially, all Max. It's a whole bunch of colonial history, all beautifully, shall we say, wrapped around one of these antique busts.
You know, you talked about Downton Abbey, for example, and when I think about what that has to do with colonialism, like this image that Britain exports of itself, I think about the fact that colonialism, it's political, it's economic, it's all the things that people generally recognize it to have been, but it's also cultural. It's expanding your image around the world.
Exactly. So Downton Abbey is sort of soft power. By the way, I should admit that I do myself watch Downton Abbey,
but it's at the same time,
it's a good show. I'm not arguing with that.
From a narrative standpoint.
But a narrative standpoint. But at the same time, all the time I'm thinking, what am I being sold here? You know, what was it that I'm being put out here? So my comments are not to say to an American audience of a consumer of this product that you're wrong. No, not at all. I'm just sort of giving a slight tweak to the whole thing and saying, well, actual fact, there's this side to things as well.
So when you say there's this side to things as well,
What I mean is that there's a darker side of things. I mean, for example, the Queen Victoria busts. Queen Victoria is obviously she's part of a colonial empire, historical colonial empire. But the what sort of gets smoothed over is all the things which were done in her name, and a lot of things which were done in her name weren't nice. You know what I mean? Britain was a colonial power.
It's not just the gloved hands.
Exactly.
Well, so at the Kemper, there is a kids area where the kids make their own boats. Have you seen that?
I haven't. And have you said this, I've got to get some images now. Because that's the thing I find really interesting.
Yeah, so they have materials for kids to make their own boats. My kid made one. He was thrilled. But thinking about that, it fills a large space within the gallery itself, which makes me really think about it, actually. Like, and I want you to imagine for a second, kids who live in Kansas City, I mean, you grew up in Guyana in the 1960s.
Yeah.
They are growing up in the middle of the United States at the beginning of 2020, which is its own very particular political moment, cultural moment.
Oh, yes.
Their parents have taken them to an art museum where they see your art, and then they make a boat. And when you imagine all of that from their perspective, what do you hope it is that they see and they walk away with?
Well, hopefully they walk away with some kind of empathy for what I'm trying to say. And what I'm trying to say is, to be honest, quite complex. I mean, as I said, I've talked about the refugee thing, and I was talking about various different types of history. I mean, history past and present. I mean, you can't dictate what your audience will walk away with. That's the thing. But the thing about boats is that people feel very differently to boats, say model boats, to how they feel about model planes. They're things they can hold in their head, they can hold in their mind. Most children can draw a boat if they've never even seen the sea, you know, I would like to think, because, as you said, the kids are making boats. It's a container for hopes and dreams. Is a container for traveling from one place to another. It's for trade. It's a container for an idea, a metaphor for a journey through life, you know?
Artist Hugh Locke, thank you so much.
Pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
Hugh's show at the Kemper is on view through January 19th. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for more art in Kansas City on KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're turning our attention to an exhibit at Ha Contemporary. It's called Who Needs This? And I'm going to let the curator, Bill Ha, tell you what that means. Bill, hello.
Hi.
So I understand that this show came together very last minute when something else fell through, leaving you just 2 weeks to come up with something else. And the phrase, who needs this, was playing in your mind. Can you tell me the story of how that particular phrase started bouncing around in there?
Sure. It actually wasn't my idea. Emily, who works with me at the gallery, and I were sitting in the back room one day and trying to figure out what we were going to do about the show that we suddenly had to plan. And she picked up a print that we had of a painting by Archie Gober called
City
Who
Guy.
Needs This. Yeah. And she's like, we ought to call the show Who Needs This. And so immediately I thought it was a great idea. But my first inclination was kind of to think of it only in a cynical way. It's like, okay, somebody just canceled on us, and it's the end of another weird year, and
who needs this?
Yeah, it's just like, okay, who needs this? But, you know, the more I thought about it and talked with people about it and asked, you know, artists that we work with kind of what they had.
That would respond in some way to that question?
Well, at the first I was just scrambling around to find something. but after a couple of days, it really seemed that the way to approach it wouldn't be to just be cynical or partisan or do something that would just kind of make us feel gross anyway afterwards. And really to kind of open up the question and open up the statement, who needs this? You know, it could be something that we don't like. It could be something cynical.
But it could be something... truly, who needs this? I have something for
right,
you.
Right. Something edifying or life-affirming or something like that. So that kind of really opened it up for us.
Every piece in this show is some kind of a riff on that question, who needs this? But the way each work of art relates to the question varies quite a bit. Can you talk about a few specific works of art with different takes on who needs this?
Okay. Well, I'll start with a really positive one. There's a piece by Dylan Mortimer where there's these stacks of piled up Nike Air Jordan shoes. As you know, Dylan has gone through 2 double lung transplants and still has cystic fibrosis. And his kind of positivity and just grace, you know, about everything.
Can we talk about the Nikes for a second? Because
sure.
For him, he grew up really like struggling with his health, but having a few things he was super into that kind of like kept him afloat in some ways.
Yep.
And one of them, he was really into like, he was very into Air Jordans.
Yeah.
He really wanted Air Jordans really bad. And it was, and some of his, like, the things he needed, like, he needed new lungs, but he sort of sees the Nikes as this sort of thing that other people can relate to, too, of the thing that you desperately, desperately want.
Right. And then there's the Air connection, too, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, that was probably on the positive end of the spectrum.
And positive because he did just have a second successful lung transplant.
Right, and it's going a lot better than the first one. It's amazing. He's running 5Ks and hiking up to the tops of mountains, and
it's a very literal who needs this. He needed lungs.
Yep. On the other end of the spectrum, there's a piece by an artist named Harold Smith who we really don't work with. And there's a number of artists that we haven't worked with in the past, and that's kind of by design as well. And it's called Stop and Frisk, and I'd say it's probably the darkest, you know, the most directly dark piece in the show.
And that's more of that, who needs this?
Right, right. I mean, it's 2019 now. Is all this stuff still happening?
Yeah. You know, it's funny, online right now, on social media, there's kind of a trend of starting a post with the line, I don't know who needs to hear this right now, or I don't know who needs to see this right now. And it always comes with but.
Right.
Which speaks to a general mood to me of despair combined with an impulse to reach out and give comfort. And that is what I think of when I see the painting by London Pierre Williams.
Mm.
It's got two young black men on a couch, presumably watching TV or something. And one of the men is barely resting his head on the other man's lap. And it's just a very tender, everyday kind of a scene, but with an intimacy that to some might feel forbidden, impossible, and seeing it there in front of them might be exactly what someone needs.
You said it better than I could. Exactly. That's why I wanted it in the show.
Tell me about the artist. Tell me about who he is and what you know about that painting.
Well, he's a junior at the Art Institute, and my friend Ari Fish, who works there, she periodically points people out to me. And
she's your scout.
Yeah, she's my scout. So I saw an image of that painting kind of in process on Instagram or somewhere. And I texted London and I said, it was over the break, actually, and asked if I could come do a studio visit. And I went in and we looked at his work and talked, and I said, well, actually, the real reason I'm here is I want to put this piece in this show. And I think he was happy about it.
Yeah.
It's really the first time we'd had a student in a show, and London, as well as another student named Jada Patterson, they both have work in this show.
Tell me about the piece by Claudia Castorino.
Okay, Claudia, she's an artist from Paraguay. She was introduced to us a couple years ago. And she usually does big installation work, and these are really small, delicate pieces. And she does a lot of work about displacement, trafficking, kind of invisible people. And these two works in there, they're these very delicate sewn pieces on tulle fabric. And one is of an upholstered car seat, and the other one is of a suitcase. And so you look at it at first, and there are these kind of charming shapes, and you know, the line in it is beautiful, but then you realize that these are methods of transporting people across borders illegally, maybe self-chosen or maybe sometimes not self-chosen, and their lives are hanging by a thread, and you could just pull this thread, it's one continuous thread that's making these shapes, you could pull the thread out of the tulle and it would just disappear. So most people probably aren't going to get that from looking at the work, but those are works that have really always that I felt strongly about, so I wanted to include those.
I'd like to turn now to an artist we have not talked about yet with work in this show. Michael Krieger is with me now. He creates landscapes that are realistic in the sense that you can tell exactly what they are, but they have an element of fantasy, and for this exhibit, he has submitted a psychedelic waterfall called Dark Times. Hi, Michael.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Tell me about the waterfall.
Yeah, so this was a piece that, you know, when Bill asked me to be in the show, I was thinking about things that I had and I was working on the studio, and this was one that I was really kind of unable to finish at the time and sort of rallied to complete it for the exhibit. it's actually called Heavy Times.
Oh, okay.
It's a waterfall, but it has a lot of sort of strong contrasts or oppositional elements in it. So in a way, it's sort of reflective of some of the things that I'm feeling, some of the things that you express to people that might be feeling despair or heavy mood or anxiety or things like that. And well, how do you do that with the landscape? And one of the ways that I tried to do that was to create a lot of oppositional elements in the picture. For example, there's a pretty forceful and strong waterfall in the background. You feel maybe the forcefulness and the power of that waterfall. And in the foreground of the picture, there's a very calm but deep, dark, kind of swirling water. So these two sort of oppositional elements. There's also an element of either sunrise or a sunset. So these moments between darkness and light.
What had originally inspired this image before Bill even spoke with you?
I mean, I've done waterfalls before, so it's kind of a place for me to go to try to find emotional content in a work. I think I'm sort of always in awe of those kinds of experiences in the landscape, like the rushing power of a waterfall. So for me, it's evocative of emotion immediately. So it's a kind of a place to draw from.
And this is actually referencing a very specific waterfall, though, right?
It is, yeah. I grew up in a falls town in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, so it was a very omnipresent part of my life. We spent a lot of time there as kids going down there. And at the time, it was a kind of a derelict area of the town. It isn't so much anymore. And we would swim there, and we would climb on the rocks. And it was, you know, a kind of important experience for me.
And this waterfall has sort of not just emotional content for you, though. It has also political references, or no?
I think it does, absolutely. Not super overt.
No, not super overt at all.
Yeah. But there, and in a way, I'm trying to find a place to put my emotions in the work of art so that other people might access them and then have a place to access their own emotions.
So the emotions provoked by the political climate.
Absolutely, yeah.
Talk to me a little bit more about that.
Well, you know, I think it's about trying to create a place for commune in a way for myself to commune with other people about how we're feeling, about the mood, trying to find maybe moments of hopefulness in a time of great uncertainty. And I've always looked to the landscape as a place to find my own emotions, and certainly also in art as a place to experience emotions and experience a
You know, it's funny. I feel like I look to the landscape for almost the opposite thing. Uh-huh. Like whatever is the sort of stressor of the moment mm-hmm. kind of disappears in the timelessness of the landscape in a way. And it's interesting to me that you see the emotion of the moment in the landscape.
I think it's possible to do that, yeah. And to feel maybe the complexities of the emotions. But I do feel a real connectedness to the landscape in that way. And so maybe that helps me to do that.
Yeah. How do you see heavy times relating to the overall question of the exhibit? Who needs this?
Who needs this? Well, I think we all need this, right? We all need more art because it does provide a place for commune and a place to find healing in a way through shared experience.
Bill, you know, when you saw this image, as I understand it, you immediately thought, this is perfect. Can you take me to your thought process?
Well, I sent Michael a text and said, we're doing this group show in 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever it was. And what are you working on right now? And he responded, he said, yeah, I'm just trying to finish up a piece called Dark Times. And sent an image of the mostly finished piece. And you know, I'm not really good at explaining. I'm really better at feeling than explaining. And actually,
you just saw Michael thought yes.
Yeah, and Michael is Michael would probably be better at it. We were talking before we came in here. It's like you're good at explaining everything I feel, but it just felt right. You know, it's you know Michael's work always has this deep resonance and this kind of emotion in it. And maybe you don't know what that emotion is. It just kind of pushes a button, at least for me.
You know, the question, who needs this, in a way, I mean, Michael kind of referenced this in a moment ago. It is also sort of just an existential question that art is always wrestling with about itself, like about its role in society or its relevance or why it matters. That's a question that art and artists are always asking. And Michael, do you think that this show, like just as a viewer of it, is an interesting way of looking at that question?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think one of the really interesting things about the exhibit is it has so many different perspectives to experience. And once you do experience all those different perspectives, you begin to have conversations or ideas about difference, which is really important today, I think.
Tell me more about that.
Well, there's just so many different points of view and
Artists being at different stages in their careers.
It's different stages in their career.
Racial backgrounds.
Absolutely, yeah, all those things. But the interesting thing also about it is that it isn't really what you might expect in a way is it to be very partisan, and it's not. And I think that creates an openness for the potential for lots of different people to experience it in different ways. And that's really important, too.
Michael Krieger, Bill Haugh, thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Who Needs This will be up through this weekend at Haugh Contemporary at their Crossroads location. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, the uplifting story of a band that got back together. It's the anniversary with a reunion show in Lawrence coming up next. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And if you were going out to hear live music in Kansas City or Lawrence in the 90s or early 2000s, you probably remember a band called The Anniversary. They were an indie rock export from our area at a time when we really didn't have a whole lot of those. They were on a good label. They put out 3 albums at a breakneck pace. They toured nationally. And then they broke up dramatically, all in a span of just a few years. Well, The Anniversary has a show in Lawrence coming up soon, nearly 20 years after that breakup. And we thought it might be cool to hear the story. The lead singer of the band is with us now, Josh Berwanger. Hello, Josh.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Everything about your band, to me, kind of speaks to a certain, like, late 90s, early 2000s aesthetic, from the sound itself to the art on the album covers. And I don't know if there is a name for it that you feel really fits you.
Yeah, both of her albums were kind of different in a way. The first one kind of got titled as the emo label, which I don't know. It's at this point, I don't care anymore about what
but
you call
it. But it bothered you then?
Yeah, it was like, I just didn't listen to that music really. And so I just didn't understand what it was. And it just was like, I was looking at, and like, I think we looked at it as more this like new wave punk rock record.
Yeah.
And so then you're like called emo and I get it. And it's fine.
Emo is short for emotional, like
yeah.
sort of shoegazy,
and, yeah,
sad guy
like,
stuff.
Yeah. And I was like, yeah, I don't, you know. And then the second record was more like kind of 60s and 70s inspired. So.
And poppy
all around. I mean, pop is, I love anything with like a hook and pop music. So
do you want to listen to a little bit of music? I think that we'll just give our listeners a little bit of a sense of what we're talking about. I've got a song that captures the anniversary sound mm-hmm. in my mind. It's from Your Majesty, the mm-hmm. record that came out in 2002. I might have bopped around to it in my apartment at the time. The song is Sweet Marie. So now, this isn't your very earliest stuff, which we will get to. This is the more polished anniversary sound, I would say.
Definitely. Yeah, we kind of started to figure out and know what we were doing more with the second record. As to the first record, we were 18 and 19 when we wrote it, and it's just kind of like, you have no idea what's going on. You know, you're just like, you're just writing, and it's just like, whatever.
Is this a song?
Is this a song? Yeah. Is this a, you know, you're making up your own chords and you're like, yeah, that works. And then as you tour and as you see other bands play and as you're like, you're exposed to all these different styles of music, you know, your influences change and you learn more on the writing and recording process. And that's definitely how we were going towards this next record or this record here.
Tell me the story of how the anniversary got started and how the band ended up catching on like it did nationwide.
Well, Justin and I, who also was a singer, is a singer in the band, and we were in these like punk bands in high school, and we were just kind of getting tired of that. It was just like so, just, you know, pop punk. It was just like, okay, it's this and that. It's just really simple, and we were listening to more, you know, The Cars and Devo and like, I don't know, just, you know, stuff going that way. And even Vitreous Humor, who was like a Lawrence band also, who were doing things really different. We just found it really fascinating. And so we wanted to kind of put all of that together. And so
I have to say, I'm surprised that The Cars are representing like complexity.
Yeah, you know, because they are kind of pop punk in a way. But the way that they did things is a little more complex. Like The Cars were one of those bands that like the frat dudes liked, but also the punk rockers liked.
Totally.
And that was really, you know, so if you're kind of blending, you know, what Vitreous Humor was doing and The Cars, and I know Vitreous Humor sounds probably obscure to certain people out there, but other people are like, oh, that makes total sense.
Yeah, what do they mean to you? That's a band out of Lawrence that maybe didn't end up getting the kind of name recognition you did.
And they should have, because they were amazing and still to this day are. And they were taking like all of those styles of music from like, it sounded like Gang of Four at times, and it sounded like, I don't know, like just their own sound.
Yeah, you seem to really like the blending of sounds and the blending of social groups and audiences. And
yeah,
like
I
that.
Think that's like what makes something catch on and like give you, instead of just being trying to recapture like exactly what the Kinks did or exactly what, or trying to have, like that's boring. It's like they did that already. So take your own sound and kind of put it into those influences of your own.
Explain a little bit for younger listeners mostly what the Lawrence scene was like back then, what the music industry was like at the moment when the anniversary came about, and how you fit into all of that.
Well, it was, you know, the Get Up Kids were moving to Lawrence from Kansas City.
Another, the probably the other big export
definitely.
The indie rock world.
And there's a band called Mates Estate, and they were in another band at the time. Gosh, I can't remember the name of that band. So they were on the scene. The Appleseed cast, who's still touring, they moved into Lawrence. And it was just this blooming music scene at the time. And, you know, it was stemming from bands like Butterglory, who were on like Merge Records, and Vicious Humor, who ended up forming The Regrets, who are on Crank Records.
Okay, wait, I want to jump in here and say you're naming a lot of very specific bands that people may or may not know what you're talking about. But
yeah,
I'm going to step back and... No, it's okay. I'm going to describe it from my own memory, which may or may not be something you agree with. But at the time, I was writing about music and culture and art and stuff for The Pitch, and so I was going out a whole bunch.
Yeah.
And my perception of the music scene back then, looking back on it, is that there was like this handful of venues that were not big venues, but they were known venues.
Definitely.
Because there was just a handful of them.
And it still is that way in Lawrence.
Yeah, and there was this handful of bands with kind of changing names, but not as much of a change in personnel as band name. And the bands tended to be, it was very loud and very like rock driven.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd see all the same people at the shows, and it was like this little world unto itself.
Yeah,
you know?
Definitely. It was kind of very different than the Kansas City music scene, which is so weird because they're so close together. But yeah, there was like the Replay Lounge was the place to play.
And it was generally a little bit more cut off from national music, I think, because it was just the very beginning of online music streaming, in the sense that it was already a thing, but it hadn't already so dramatically changed the whole industry, the way people accessed music.
Definitely. Like Napster was like 2001, maybe, something like that, I think. And then but still, people were buying physical media.
So your breakout story is a little different than like what you would hear of a band like getting a national audience today.
Yeah. Are you saying like how getting signed?
Yeah.
Getting
a label, like all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's huge.
It's different. Like I feel like if you're a band in Kansas, you're probably not going to get signed to a label outside of, I mean, it happens, but it's much harder. It was easier. It was easy for, the Get Up Kids went out on tour and got really big, and they toured with, you know, Promise Ring and Jimmy Eat World, and then a lot of labels wanted to sign them, and then Vagrant did, and then they started their own little label, and then they signed us, and then we record our record and just toured.
And people who are into music followed labels.
Yes, and that was like Lookout Records was like, if any band that came out on Lookout because of Green Day or Epitaph, and then that happened with Vagrant. It was like Get Up Kids, Anniversary, Hot Rod Circuit, Alkaline Trio, Dashboard Confessional, Saves the Day.
And one of the Kansas City bands that kind of had a national audience, Rex Hobart and the Misery Boys, mm-hmm. their breakout was getting signed to Bloodshot.
Exactly, yeah.
So that was kind of how it worked at the time. So that all being established.
Yeah, it was a wild time.
Yeah. Were you kind of surprised about like breaking out and getting that indie rock label follower kind of fame?
I just don't think we thought about it. It was because we just like literally like in, I think a week, we 20 years ago, we left on our first tour, and we did the East Coast, the West Coast, then we went to Europe for a month and a half, and then we came back and just toured and just didn't stop. And
was this like couch surfing touring or
the first,
in hotels?
The first tour was couch surfing. Luckily, we had a tour bus in Europe already, so spoiled. when we came back, it was starting to get a little bigger, and we were able to start kind of sharing a hotel room and then getting two hotel rooms. And then, you know, sometimes we had a Winnebago or a bus or which was nice. But
so then tell me about the breakup.
Well, I mean, it was a very tough breakup, and we were so young and everything happened so fast. I mean, we put out our first record in 2000, the second record came out in 2002, and we broke up in 2003. So it was a whirlwind, and we just went through a very somewhat Fleetwood Mac-esque breakup where, you know, not getting into total details, but we're kids and we met in our practice space. We weren't kind of on the same page as each other and weren't getting along, weren't hanging out anymore. And this is coming from, you know, 1999 to 2000, end of 2002, beginning of 2003, we were together every day, every minute. And then suddenly we kind of weren't, and, you know, we just weren't getting along and we broke up.
Yeah. Well, what brought you back together? How did that happen?
I still technically don't think we're back together as much as just like...
You have reunions.
But I just don't know what else you call it. It's like, we're not going to put out another record. We're not. But the answer to that, though, is like, since we broke up so like prematurely, immaturely, however you want to say it, you know, a few of us hadn't seen each other since we did those shows. You know, it's been like 16 years.
Wow.
And we had, it was like... to resolve and to see each other. And that's the main reason we're doing this, is because it's to be together and hang out and like kind of like laugh and like
heal
exactly, and do, and that's like what the music is now. It's not so much like, you know, we're sitting up there pouring our hearts into these lyrics that were written when we were 18 or 21. It's the energy comes from being on stage and playing together.
So you're getting ready to play some music that you have not played in going on 2 decades. And I imagine some of it feels different now. I want to play a song as an example. This is Without Panasos. Is that how you say that?
That's right. Panasonic.
Okay, here we go. So Josh Berwanger of The Anniversary, you'll be playing this song for the first time in what, 18 years at the Bottleneck in Lawrence?
This one probably about 18 years. It's good to hear it because we're still trying to figure it out. It's so like, there's so many parts and like obscure chords in it. And we were messing around with it last night, just like laughing and like being like, what the heck are we doing in this song?
What the heck are you doing in this
song? I don't
song?
Know. Will you tell me? I need help.
I know.
Can someone...
tell you.
Find me on social media and tell me how to play this song. We all need to know.
What is it that feels different to you about it now that you suddenly don't know how to play it?
All the, like, there's like tuned down, we like tuned down on certain parts. There's like these chords that are just like, you put your finger, it's not like you're playing a C chord or like a D chord. It's like.
Yeah, I can't hum a melody of this to you.
I can't either. Which just like, I don't know. Sometimes I like look at it as like early Metallica, not as good as early Metallica, obviously. But where they're just doing all these like wild, like different structures, and you're like, wait, this part? And so, yeah.
I love this as like the soundtrack to healing, though, because I think in our sort of current era, like something meditative would be like, I heal to this music. You're going to heal playing this music with your buddies.
Yeah, and it's going to be good. It's going to be fun. There'll be a lot of laughter.
There is also a song that you are pulling out of the old repertoire that you never played live at all. That's mind-boggling.
Yeah, Outro in a Minor, which is the last song on Designing a Nervous Breakdown. We just kind of, we never played it live. So tonight actually is the first time we're getting together as a whole, to run through stuff, and tomorrow to get ready rehearsals and things. So
let's listen to that song.
We'll see how it goes. I'd love to hear. I need to still kind of figure it out.
We can get some work done while you're listening. Okay, let's listen to Outro in No Minor.
Far from our homes, the heat will flash behind the dash. It gathers. Such winds blow cold. The fiction of your life slum, so deep in the blood, taking pictures of all of this.
What sent you back to this particular song when you had plenty to choose from that you had done a gazillion times and probably, you know, had gotten down a little bit more? Like, it's not as easy to pull out the song you haven't done live before.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes tonight. But, you know, the whole idea behind this, these shows coming up, was to do Designing a Nervous Breakdown front to back.
That's the first album.
Yeah, and then do a second, like, kind of encore set of 5 to 6 Your Majesty songs. So we just thought it'd be fun to do that since it's been 20 years, and... 20-year anniversary.
Yeah. No. And also, when you call your band the anniversary, it is sort of tragic if you don't get to have those momentous anniversaries.
Yeah, you have to have one, right? I mean, you can't not.
Yeah, you sort of set yourself up for that. But your show at the Bottleneck, it starts at 9 p.m., and I generally find the start times of shows pretty uninteresting. I can't think of a time when I've discussed it during an interview. But the people who went to your shows early on are not generally staying up quite as late as they used to. And when a band says they're starting at 9, they are never really starting at 9. Yeah. So I have to assume you anticipate more than just 40-somethings reliving nostalgia for the early 2000s, like a whole new fan base that is younger.
You know, when we did those shows about 2 years, 3 years back, we were getting fathers bringing their daughters and sons, and then like some brothers had like sisters who were too young during the time, and they introduced them to, well, I remember that vividly. That's why I'm saying sister. And those kind of experiences. They're like, I thought I would never get to see you. And I thought, and that's kind of like a really cool thing to think about.
It's like the town version of that thing where like, why am I blanking on the name of the band?
The Wonders?
No.
The
anyway,
O-meters?
It doesn't matter. There's that band that you thought you'd never get to see that's like the big national name. But like in Lawrence, you guys are the band that some people thought they'd never get to see.
Yeah, I guess so. And especially since, you know, it was such a quick, you know, 3 years.
The Pixies is the band I was thinking.
The Pixies. That's a good example. Yeah. There's a bunch of them, really, you know. Like I thought I'd never get to see Guns N' Roses.
But is there, for the kind of music that we just listened to, which, depending on which song we're talking about, I think the emo label would apply a little more to the last one, whereas definitely. Sort of like psychedelic, punky rock, more to the first one. But the audience that existed for this sort of kind of music in the early 2000s, is there a new audience for that kind of music now?
I think like emo is like more popular now, supposedly, than it was when it was actually like it's still a thing, but like when it was starting, I guess is the better way to put it. I think that was more underground. I think now, and then it went through like a mall punk emo phase.
What is that?
Like, I think that was like people categorizing, like, what is that band with the two brothers? They like kind of rapped, but they also, I don't know, like My Chemical Romance, that kind of thing was like kind of like becoming like, it was like mall emo, I think. Everyone's going to get mad at me or something for saying that.
No,
but fine.
Mall emo sounds.
What was that? I can't. Like Newfound Glory and like those kind of bands, and Fall Out Boy, that's a good one. Like, I think that was becoming like emo, which, you know, I don't know if that, I'm not the best historian on the genre.
But like obscure bands from back then are now having a mainstream renaissance kind of.
I think so. I mean, like, you know, I think like that's more. I think there's newer bands that are like bringing that genre back. And I think it's really becoming popular again. But hey, don't quote me. I'm not like, you know, I'm not an emo dude.
But no, I mean, so I guess that makes me wonder if the sort of concern about labels feels less significant to you now that you're older and that the labels aren't so fresh with all of the charge that they carried kind of. And that there's this newer audience that kind of gives you maybe some fresh appreciation for it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the anniversary kind of was always like just, we don't like, we're label-less. Like, why do we have to have, you know, if we put out this second record that sounds like the Stones or like Pink Floyd at times or Black Sabbath or whatever, and then still having a few of those influences from the Design Universe Breakdown record, it's just like, how do you label those two things? You know, when people like refer to us, they're like, oh, they kind of were, but they kind of weren't, you know? And it's just like, why label yourself? I don't know.
Do you feel like that you have found some sort of peace with something by returning to this music that you didn't have before the reunions began?
I mean, the peace comes from just hanging out with the band. That's it. You know, that's the greatest part about it, is seeing them and getting to play music with them again and getting to tell like all the inside joke stories from when we were young. And
it's the language of your friendship.
That's right.
Aw, Josh Berwanger of The Anniversary, thanks for being here and thanks for telling your band's story.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Anniversary has a reunion anniversary show coming up at The Bottleneck. It'll be on February 1st at 9 p.m. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's a wrap for today. You can grab any of the audio from today's show at kcur.org/Central Standard. We'll have it for you by the end of the day. kcur.org/Central Standard. We've covered 2 art exhibits and a rock show, but we know that there's more, so talk to us on Twitter about what's coming up in town that you are really excited about, the artists you want to hear from. We're at KCUR CST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day. And our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs right here in Kansas City. Have a great weekend. Up to Date is next.